After Lent, I'll shorten them up. But John is very long-winded. He's almost as bad as I am. And so to get the whole story in, it's a long trip in John to get it all done. Nobody in the town was really expecting anything. In that sense, it wasn't that different from most small towns. Pretty much business as usual. Monday looks like Tuesday. Tuesday looks like Wednesday. Wednesday looks a lot like Thursday. Then you get to Friday evening, and you get the Sabbath beginning, and everyone goes to synagogue. And then everybody takes a rest during the day on Saturday, and the whole thing begins again. Pretty soon, living in a town like this, you don't really expect very much. You don't expect anything to change. And then when something does, your inclination is not to really believe it. You know these people all your life. They haven't changed as long as you've known them, so I don't know why they should start now. And this is why small town life can be pretty predictable. You probably had a friend and two in your life who you've known, maybe in college, maybe afterwards, who maybe it's someone in your family who periodically decides they're going to change their life. And they march in one day, and you know, maybe the person who kind of messes things up periodically, but they march in, they say, well, I've decided I'm going to change now. I've read this, or I've seen this, or I've talked to this person, and you know, I'm convinced now I'm going to change. And you've heard it about 15 times already. And you want to do that thing that I wish I could do. My brother and my mother could do it. And that's raise one eyebrow without raising the other one. You know, I've always wanted to do that. And that's probably how you react to most of this news when somebody says that. Like, oh, here we go again. It's not going to last. I've known them my whole life. I know that they sound like this. Well, that's kind of what living in a small town is like, where you know everyone and you know everything about them. And you've heard them make a vow 50 times to change their life. And when they come in with the 51st try, you raise your eyebrow. Because quite frankly, you and I both know that people don't change that often. They might need to. They might feel the need to. They might want to change. But actually changing is a whole other issue. So the blind man is sitting in a small town, and he's not expecting anything to change. It's Saturday, during the day, on the Sabbath. Nobody's paying any particular attention to anyone, particularly him, because he's the blind guy. And I'm sure that's how he was known. He's been blind all his life. And to tell you the truth, most people in town don't really like to look at him. Who wants to be reminded of what potentially could happen to you? So he's all by himself. Expectations are really low for anything this day to have much change. And then along, he's sitting there, and along come a group of people. And he can hear them. And he knows that they've stopped in front of him. And they're talking about him. They're not talking to him. They're talking about him. Well, the guy's thinking, nobody talks to me much anyway. It's clear that people around, because of my blindness, I'm on the outside. I'm seen as something less than. So why should they be talking to me? And they're not. They're talking about him. They're talking philosophy. He's just become a philosophical case study. Well, he just happens to be sitting right in front of them. And the question is, who caused his blindness? The blind guy probably thinks, if I've heard this one time, I've heard it 1,000. Most of the time, he knows the answer. Somebody sinned. Him, his parents, his grandparents, somebody a long time ago. Because when bad things happen, he knows as well as anybody, it's not just random. That's not what people believe. It's not random. There's got to be a reason for bad things happening, and blindness is seen as a very bad thing. So you have to put the blame on somebody. Nobody's a scientist back then. So the only possible answer is that somebody did something wrong sometime, and whether it's him or his parents or his grandparents or his family, something must have caused this bad thing to happen. because life isn't just random. Things just don't happen out of the blue. And then the leader of the group, the blind man can kind of tell, I think, it's the leader because there's this kind of change in the atmosphere. As everybody, he feels almost, people lean forward. The leader answers the question. The question of whose sin caused this, with the answer, nobody really. That to the blind man would have been a very strange answer, because it has to be someone's fault. Then the same man, the man who's leading the group, says, it's so the glory of God might be shown through him. And who knows what that means, but it's the first time the blind man has actually heard himself in any sense having been referred to as exhibiting any of the glory of God. And then the leader, the rabbi, whoever it is, says some other mysterious mumbo-jumbo about darkness and blindness and light and other stuff. And the next thing you know, the rabbi doesn't even ask permission. He never talks to the guy. He just picks up some mud. He mixes it with spit. This is the common folk cure for blindness, by the way. If you look back there, this is what people did. If you were a folk healer, you mixed mud and spit together and you put it on somebody's eyes. And the blind guy is sitting there, and all I can picture him thinking is, well, this is life as usual. People usually poke and prod me, get along, get out of my way. He's not unused to people just coming up and doing stuff to him without asking. Sure enough, the mud goes on the eyes, and the rabbi or whoever it is says, I want you to go over to the pool and jump in the pool that's called Scent. And the man probably thinks, might as well, I've got mud on my eyes now. I want to get it off. And there's nothing else to do. It's just the town. So off he goes, finding his way to the pool, jumping into the pool, and lo and behold, he can see. And for him, it's an amazing moment because he all of a sudden comes out of the pool, and for the first time in his life, he can actually see. And there's all this light and all these shadows and all these people that he's never seen before. And I can imagine animals that didn't look at all the way he thought they were going to look. And his mind must have been racing 1,000 miles an hour. And he's barely able to contain himself. And he kind of stumbles his way back to the person and introduces himself to Jesus. Well, the whole thing is causing a stir in town because, quite frankly, nothing ever happens in this town. And word is getting around when anything does happen. And the word that's getting around now is this blind guy has his sight. And a crowd begins to gather around, as you might expect they would, because it's something huge that's happened in this town where nothing ever happens. And not only is it huge, it's upset the very laws of nature. And everyone's curious about what's going on. So the gathering crowd gathers around, and they look at this guy at first glance, and it may be that the rumors are true. It may be the blind guy's got his sight, but nobody really knows for sure. And someone in the crowd says, I'm not sure it's the blind guy. I haven't looked at him in a long time. He's not a guy, by the way, that you'd welcome around town. He's not a guy you would let hang out by the pool very often, certainly when you were there. And someone in the crowd says, I don't know, how often have we really looked at this guy? Are we sure it's even the same guy? And his friend says, well, you know, you have a point there. The guy's been here for a long time, but this guy looks a little shorter than the guy I thought normally sat here. And somebody else says, well, I don't remember the beard. Been a long time, but I don't remember the beard that way. So people go back and forth, and then they decide, well, let's go get the religious leaders in town. They're the smart people. Religious leaders are always the smartest people in town. That's true of historically, by the way, from the beginning of time to now. And so they find the religious leaders. They want to get some clarity on it, and these prestigious, important people in town. And they come to see what's gone on with this blind guy. well, they, one of the first things they want to do is make sure that this is, in fact, the blind guy. So they go, well, let's see his parents. Let's go see his parents. His parents will say whether he's been born blind or not. His parents are good churchgoers. They'll be honest with us. Now, for the parents, who are probably a poor family, this is a big, big deal. All of a sudden, the most important people in town have marched over to your doorstep, knocked on your door, and said to you, is that your son, and was he born blind? And the parents probably go something like, well, technically, he's our son. Because the parents realize that if they give the wrong answer here, they may be out of the synagogue. And that's their life. And who wants to be thrown out of the synagogue and not have any friends? So they go, well, you know, technically, yes, we gave birth, or his mother gave birth. So in that sense, he's our son. And why he's not blind anymore, you ask him, and we don't want to cause trouble. And the envoys leave, and all of a sudden, everybody relaxes in the house. So the next thing, the crowds led by these important folks take the blind guy, and if he's really cured of his blindness, then now we need to figure out why. So whether he wants to go or not, they take him to the religious sages, and everybody gathers around, and they said, who cured you? And he says, Jesus. And they try to quiz him on his relationship to Jesus, but all he knows is, I was blind, and now that I see. That's all I know. Because that's, in fact, all he really does know at this point. And most of the people who've never spoken to him, probably in his whole life, except to say, get lost or get out of my way, ask him, pepper him with questions, and he keeps saying, I don't know, I couldn't see, and now I can. So now the religious people and everybody else standing around has two choices to make. They have two options here. One of which involves self-examination. One of which could be, they could use this as an opportunity to re-examine their own attitude towards people who they treated with contempt for decades. They could look at people who they've often labeled as different from me or other than me. And they could change their behavior towards him. Or maybe they could worry less about whose sin caused the problems and more about why we've been ignoring this guy for most of his life and not welcoming him in. So that even when something happens, we're not even sure it's him. That's option number one. Or they have option number two, which is to have a philosophical debate. Not about themselves, but about the nature of sin and healing and the Sabbath. It would make really an interesting discussion group. That's what they decide to do. The people attend. They served, I think, coffee and cookies. They had a great discussion on the nature of Sabbath and sin and evil. And it was good food for thought, and everyone got to go home. And life got to be normal in the village, except for the fact that now they had a story to tell. The day one guy who supposedly was blind got cured. And next thing you know, it's Sunday. And then it's Monday, and the week goes on. Now, the way I just retold the story is not the emphasis that John wants to have. I will admit that. This is not the story, the reason John tells the story. The details were the same, but in John, the story is all metaphor. It's all metaphor about how Jesus is the light of the world, and Jesus will make the blind see, and it's meant to be a metaphor for your own spiritual blindness, and you will, if you follow Jesus, have that blindness cured and know the truth. That's what John wants you. And so the pool that's called sent is the word that John uses for what Jesus is. He's sent to earth, and so it's very symbolic. But I kept thinking about this story as if it wasn't a metaphor, that this was maybe a story that happened to a real person. The story of a man who was an outcast, who was in need, who was ignored every single day because he reminded people of the frailty of life and the thing that could happen to you. He was a sign of what might happen if you or your family committed bad behavior. and you'd be punished. This is the kind of thing you might be punished. He was a lesson, in other words. Not a human being with needs or anything in common with the rest of the town. He is just sitting there, minding his own business. Jesus comes along without even, by the way, a request from the man. The man never says, cure me of my blindness. The man never says, I believe in you, Jesus. Jesus simply heals him because he's sitting there. And not only does nobody in the town want to believe it happened, they don't even want to deal with the idea of healing or look at their own behavior or deal with the world that has suddenly changed. They want to discuss the finer points of theology. They might as well have responded to the healing of the feeding of the 5,000 with a study commission on the economic implications of social welfare. Now, yesterday, many of us sat in that room across the way, and we were talking about church. We were talking about this church. We were talking about churches in general who are in trouble, churches who are trying to figure out their own future, and how some of these churches become so focused on themselves and that they forget what they're called to do, which is to go out into the world and do God's work, to find God in the world. It's if most churches are living in a town where it seems like nothing ever changes. So when a blind man does get healed, or a poor mother might get a check at the first of the month so that she doesn't have to stretch the food for that week before anymore until there wasn't anything left. Most churches want to talk about their theology or their ideas about church rather than the people who might be standing right in front of us. Blind people, poor people, marginalized people, left out people, old people, excluded people, infirm people, they're all around us. And it's hard not to look, but we manage sometimes not to look. So that when something miraculous happens, we aren't even sure it's the person who was there in the first place. And it's easy to do that because it can be overwhelming. It's overwhelming, just like it's overwhelming to feel us talk about reinventing who we are as a church. To go from worrying about attendance on a Sunday morning to thinking about the church as a shared ministry of people who work in the community. A community which on its surface appears to have few problems, but as I think we're beginning to discover, has many more problems than that. A community which appears to have very little interest in what we have to say or anything to do with God. So I was thinking about this as I drove home. And I was thinking about how disorienting this whole shift in emphasis has to be for everybody in the church. And when this church began to talk in that last hour, and for those of you that weren't here, it was a wonderful experience for me to sit and listen in the back as you guys talked for an hour as if you were a church that wanted to make a difference in the world and find where God was working in the world. It was just an amazing turnaround. And I was thinking how scary that must be, because I don't know where it's going to go. I hate to say that. Maybe you thought I did. I don't know where it's going to go for you. But I am sure, I am positive, that it's going to go someplace good. But here's the good news for you, if you're nervous like I suspect you are, is that you have seen God at work already. You have seen God at work in your life when you were down that time and you couldn't for the life of you figure out where you were supposed to go next and how you would ever see the light of life again. And you did see. You have seen God at work when you sat here on a Sunday and wondered if this church would even be here in a year or two. And if you look around and you feel the Spirit here, you can see that it is not only here, but it's populated by a group of people who are incredible, who are just discovering new gifts every month. who are just becoming aware of the difference you can really make in the world. You have seen God at work when you were lost, and you felt your way along because you didn't know where you were headed next. And suddenly the path before you cleared up, came into focus, and you could get your footing and begin to walk forward again. You have seen God at work, and you will see God at work again, I promise you. It's just that it's kind of scary to be heading toward that pool that's called scent. All I'm asking, all God is asking, is not to be afraid to jump.